Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to meet an expert in his or her field who gives us a way to think about things that perhaps we haven't considered before. Certainly today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Harry Hertunian. I have permission to call him Dr. Harry, but I figured I'd get his full name out there at least once. Dr. Harry, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. Nice to be here.
Now, Dr. Harry is described as a physician director and of licensed health professionals at the Betty Ford Center in California. He is board certified in addiction and family medicine and is internationally known speaker and authority on addiction-oriented topics. And Dr. Harry, what brings you here today is a conversation that I think we don't have enough of. And also, you have written a book specific to this conversation. And the title of the book is Not As Prescribed, Recognizing and Facing Alcohol and Drug Misuse in Older Adults. And certainly when we think about drug use, when we think about alcohol use and abuse, we don't think about senior citizens.
That's correct. Absolutely correct. You know, the problem is drug misuse and addiction, as well as polypharmacy, use of multiple medications among men and women age 50 and older, the fastest growing and most unrecognized health problem in the country.
The fastest growing and most unrecognized. That's pretty astounding.
Yeah, it sure is.
Why?
Sheer numbers of people affected is what's so astounding.
Well,
go ahead.
Give us a sense of the numbers of people who are affected.
Well, there's two groups. We can talk about the age 50 and older. This book of mine is really co-marketed by AARP, and you know, I can remember that one time I was married to a woman who was a few years older than I, and when she turned 50, I received my AARP card in my 40s. So they identify 50 as the age that you're a charter member, I think, of AARP. And then, of course, we have those people who we identify as the baby boomers who are 65 and older. So, you know, let's just take a look at those people who are in the older group, 65 and up. If you take a look at the size of that group, the first wave of which became 65 years of age around 2011, about 10,000 people turn 65 years of age every day in this country.
Huh.
And that will go on for the rest of a generation. And the numbers of people in that baby boomer generation approaches 72 million people. Now, not everybody who uses drugs or alcohol has a problem, but it would be fair to say that, you know, about 10% of that number may be affected at any point in time, and another significant group may be teetering or at the threshold of a problem that can be avoided or averted by vigilant caretakers.
Given that, first of all, the numbers that you offer really are almost breathtaking. You talk about folks being able to make a difference. How does one even begin to think about mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, great-grandma having a drug or alcohol problem?
Well, just look at sheer numbers. If we think about 17% of older adults misuse alcohol and prescription drugs, When we include misuse, we're not just talking about addiction, we're talking about dangerous use, having that glass of wine with that sleeping pill, that kind of thing. And, you know, 70% is a huge number. And when you get up to numbers like 6 million by 2020, an alarming number of people may be affected. The widowers over the age of 75 suffer the highest rate of alcoholism in the United States right now for new onset. Lots of reasons for that. They oftentimes are widowed. They are widowed. They are lonely. They are not necessarily accountable to family and peers, maybe living alone, and they start drinking alcohol at alarming rates. You know, when denial is a family disease that affects the family of people who are misusing drugs and affects the person who's misusing drugs. If we get involved in some sort of collusion with our loved one by subscribing to the denial, it could never happen to them. You'll oftentimes see siblings who are caring for an older adult at odds with each other. One says, "Mom's got a problem." The other one says, "Don't be ridiculous." And for many different reasons. And when that happens, then we've got a very serious problem because the person is getting sicker and sicker and sicker as the denial prevents proper intervention and care.
Well, one of the things that you say about this issue is that the baby boomer generation is more likely than previous generations to use drugs as they begin to age. Why is that?
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. You know, there's an interesting little term that I absolutely love. It's called the silver tsunami.
Yes.
Did you hear that, RK?
I have, yes.
Okay, the silver tsunami. And, you know, what does that really mean? It means that people who grew up in the 60s culture oftentimes had an invitation to openly experiment with drugs. There was a lot of plot around alcohol, partying, pills. You know, it was the love generation and Woodstock, and they did so with impunity. And then many of them settled down into lives involving family and career and left that. But that didn't mean that the attitude went away. They still can use drugs as a go-to position. Relieving themselves of pain and suffering is still considered a right and privilege by many. This silver tsunami thing of retirees that we have are the drug, sex, and rock and roll generation mentality. Add to that the combination of I must have my pain dealt with now, I need a pill, and the prescription painkiller epidemic that we have in this country, and the collective conditioning of a society and culture that now uses about 80% or more of the world's pain relievers are used in this country. There's a pill for everything. So there is, I think, reason to feel that we are a targeted generation, and it's exploding since 2011.
Well, I know that you know that there are people who will say if they acknowledge that grandma or great grandpa are having a drinking problem, but then the next thing they're going to say is, at their age, what does it matter? If they want to drink, let them have a drink.
Okay.
What do
well,
you say to that?
Now you're talking right up my alley. This is great stuff.
Okay.
This is great stuff. Keep going.
Okay.
So about 50% of the boomer generation grew up experimenting with drugs, and as I said, most gave them up. They usually become comfortable returning to drugs to ease their stress, their grief, their boredom, financial worries, all the things that happens in older adulthood and retirement. Now, I didn't even talk about physical issues, chronic pain issues, other medication, medical issues. We'll talk about polypharmacy and the travesty of multiple doctors not having the common decency of talking with each other about what a patient is getting. That's a huge part of this problem.
Let's say I've discovered that great-granddad has a little bit of a drinking problem, just a little bit. Maybe he had a half a dozen bottles of beer and maybe a fifth of scotch. And, you know, they were there on Monday, but now it's Thursday and they're kind of not there. But, you know, he's an old dude. Why don't we just leave him alone?
I talk about this in my book, and it's common beliefs about older adults' drug misuse. It's the only pleasure left at his age.
Exactly.
He's just seeing mom. He worked so hard all his life. Let him enjoy itself. It's her money. Let her spend it. He's in too much pain to abstain from painkillers. Happy hour is the only social activity she has left. He has nothing else to do. Who is he harming? Since mom passed, it helps him with his loneliness. It's a disease. There's nothing you can do. He needs to reach his own bottom. The family can't afford treatment. He's too confused to be treated anyway. It's the only fun he has left at his age. We are all guilty in that of something I call ageism, a prejudice or discrimination against a particular age group, especially against the elderly. And it's prevalent in our United States youthful culture. We equate an older adult's active drinking and drugging to one of life's last well-deserved hurrahs. And we are saying that they don't value this person anymore. You know, they're not giving up anything. Let them fade out in oblivion and get stoned. Okay, so that we're guilty of ageism. Some of the most productive patients I've ever treated got started in sobriety in their 80s.
In their 80s?
In their 80s.
And you make reference to a colleague of yours, Michael Walsh, the president and CEO of the National Association of Addiction Providers, and you let us know in your book that he says the oldest person he ever treated was 91. We just don't think in those terms.
Let me tell you something. I just got this beautiful letter yesterday from Columbus, Ohio. I was out there speaking, and a beautiful lady wrote me and said, I looked for you after your lecture to try to thank you for my mom's experience at the Betty Ford Center. She came to you when she was 85 years of age to get sober from her alcohol problem. And what she was alluding to is that mom, during treatment, it was recognized, had another medical problem that needed some serious treatment. She had a breast cancer. And we sent her home to get properly treated, but not until she had been positively affected by our program, by Alcoholics Anonymous and so forth. And she was calling me or writing me to thank me that her mother, 24 months later, died a sober woman. Now, what does that mean? It means that those last years of her life, she was active. Yes, she was dealing with a medical problem. She was engaging with grandchildren and children. She was happier. She was worthwhile. She was involved in her hobbies. She was enjoying life like never before. I hear that all the time. One other gentleman that I have who was intervened upon by Betty Ford herself, an old family friend, got sober when he was 85. He and I had lunch last week. He's now 96. And during the last 10 years, he's written two extraordinary books on spirituality. He's helped countless numbers of people, especially in the prison population where he distributed this book, find strength and hope in their life, and states that, you know, these last 10 years were the best of my life.
It really is extraordinary. And again, it reminds us all, and I think too many of us forget, that just because you're over the age of fill in the blanks, it doesn't mean that you're too old to have a vibrant and important life ahead of you for as long as you do.
Exactly.
You tell the story of Betty, who was a mother and a grandmother and a widow, who became addicted to prescription medications. Is that more common in the aging population than alcoholism, or do they kind of share the same numbers?
No, in the aging population, where people, we see a lot of people in our pain program here at the Betty Ford Center that present primarily addicted to their primary pain medication. Yeah, that's huge right now.
And so if people are dealing with chronic pain and they're aging, they need pain medication, yes?
They do. I'm not in favor of not treating pain appropriately, but I'm very much in favor of treating it with the least medication possible to get good results and no adverse combination of medications that put you at greater risk. You know, polypharmacy is the taking of multiple medications, supplements, minerals, herbs, over-the-counter medications for chronic health conditions, acute conditions, and some people take them just for their general well-being. I've had patients come into the center here with bags of 25 and 35 bottles of medication. Some of those medications have been prescribed by three or four different doctors. Some of the medications prescribed by different doctors are the same medication. One written as the brand name, one written as the generic name. So if the patient's taking one of each of those, he's doubling the dose and doesn't even know it. Now, very seldom do those physicians ever speak to each other. They don't even know the patient's seeing another doctor. And unless the patient is honest about that up front, they can't communicate. So, you know, how many medications do you get at the pharmacy where that little sticker is on there and says, don't take it with alcohol?
Right.
I mean, you know, there's countless numbers of them. People get used to, you know, an uninterrupted lifestyle that I'm going to have my glass of sherry or my glass of wine late in the day, or, you know, my cocktail that I used to have with my beloved Emma will be, I'll have it every night and toast to the old girl in front of her picture every night. But you're not taking into account that there might have been a couple of Vicodin for the back pain or arthritis or Ambien that's going to be taken in an hour or two when you go to bed. These are significantly dangerous combinations. Many people in older age groups are on benzodiazepines for sleep, restlessness, and anxiety. This is Valium, Xanax, Ativan, those kinds of drugs. Mixed with alcohol, it's a deadly combination. So, you know, what is the result of that? Families are struggling to see, is mom getting the side effects of advanced aging? Is this early dementia? Is it polypharmacy? One drug added to the next? Just side effects of the drugs? Or have they had a stroke? Or are they being addicted? Are they getting addicted? Are they hiding their medications? Are they hiding alcohol in the house? You come home and find that they're unresponsive, can't pick up the telephone, don't remember anything. Most of the side effects of many of these medications is completely wiping out the memory. And that's not just from benign medications. Some of the medications that are most difficult is simple Benadryl, you know, the component of Advil, Tylenol, PM. Those PM medications will oftentimes have Benadryl in them, which severely can impair an older adult's memory. So people forget that they've taken a pill and they take a double dose.
So indeed, this actually becomes a very complicated, painfully common experience for many people, and certainly for many older people. And we're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I want to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago when you talked about medication, supplements, minerals, and herbs, because I think it's fair to say that many people see the supplements, minerals, and herbs in an entirely separate category and tend not to report that. But we'll pick up there when we come back. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Dr. Harry Hartounian, who is the Physician Director, Licensed Health Professionals Program at the Betty Ford Center in California, and author of Not As Prescribed, A Guide for Families and Caregivers. We'll be back in a moment. Dr. Harry, for those individuals who are taking their prescription medications, but when asked by a physician or a physician's assistant or whomever, what medications are you taking, they don't include supplements, they don't include minerals and herbs, because they don't see them as being part of the same spectrum. What do you say to folks who are thinking that way?
Well, you know, most medications started out being developed from plants and herbs and natural remedies. And plants, herbs, and natural remedies can have many side effects and interactions with many synthetic medications. So they certainly can have an effect on each other and on a person's mental status. So they absolutely should be included. I think that if one good thing comes out of an interview like this, anybody who's in this age group or their family should immediately go to the side table in the bedroom or the bathroom of their loved one and pull every single medication or herbal supplement out and write them all down. It's easy to do this on a cell phone. Just write them down. If you're not sure, take a picture of the label and have those whenever you accompany your loved one to the doctor and say, I want this transcribed into my mom or dad's record. I want everything that they take to be there. And I want you to do a medication audit. Now, he's got six doctors prescribing these 24 different bottles of medication. Do any of them interact adversely? Are any of them unnecessary? Which ones are expired that we should throw away? I mean, you know, medications in the medicine cabinet are a very, very dangerous place. And one of the chief sources for young people to get the opiate pain medications and other prescription medications that are involved in this epidemic that we have going on now, they go and get it out of their grandparents' or parents' medicine cabinets. We still have that mentality in our culture, and that is don't throw anything away. I mean, I grew up having my mother say, don't waste it. What about the starving kids in China, you know?
Right.
And we don't throw them away. So why not keep? Grandma goes and gets her hip surgery, and she realizes that the Vicodin or OxyContin that they gave them causes severe constipation. Now, Grandma's a tough, she's a tough old broad. You know, she's a wonderful lady, but she said, I'm not going to suffer constipation for a little hip pain. Give me some Motrin instead. And she takes Motrin and puts, you know, 40 OxyContin or 60 or 100 of them in the medicine cabinet. They never get thrown away, but they do get found.
So again, folks, anyone who's listening, for yourself and for anyone you care about, take a look at all of the bottles or the packages of pills that your loved ones, including yourself, may be taking. And when you say ask for a medication audit, is it your...
The easiest way is to take the whole, you know, if you don't feel up to doing it yourself, take the whole bag into the doctor's office.
Okay.
And sit down with the nurse or medical assistant and say, let's do an audit of what's necessary, what's duplicated, what's expired. And, you know, you'll go home with half the bottles. That's a great thing to do. And find out which ones could be causing the side effects we're concerned about. I'm worried that Dad had a stroke. He's awfully imbalanced. Well, he's taken three blood pressure medications, so his blood pressure is way too low. Of course he's imbalanced. He's going to almost nearly faint. If he falls down and breaks his hip, his life is over. You know, so it's a very worthwhile endeavor. Now, you can also get a medication audit from your pharmacist and just go to the pharmacist. Go to a little local small pharmacy. The big chains never seem to take the time that you need to really speak to a good pharmacist who knows what he's doing. You go talk to them and show everything. And they have computer
software
programs that we just enter all the medicines in, and the computer will spit out adverse combinations in seconds.
I note that you have said the adults who you see at the Betty Ford Center, they tend to come in taking 5 to 20 different legally prescribed drugs. And so, again, it's hard for some people to think about drug addiction and prescription drugs in the same sentence, although certainly it happens. But is it your sense that there's a growing awareness of this problem, or do you think that people, by and large, are still seeing it as a separate issue? Drug addiction is separate from prescription drug addiction.
Well, anybody who still looks at drug addiction as just a moral dilemma is not paying attention. This is a disease of the brain that gets exposed to the same medications over and over again, gets sensitized to those medications, builds a tolerance to those medications, starts craving those medications, and then the medication is needed just to feel normal. And that's what addiction's all about. And then there are cravings for those medications. And then when one doesn't work, a combination may be better. And so the combinations can get very dangerous. The problem is that older folks don't tolerate these doses and don't tolerate the side effects very well. So, you know, adverse drug alcohol reactions is responsible for an enormous number of emergency room visits that the EMTs will tell you. They get calls all the time from families that say, you know, dad, mom's unresponsive. Well, they took a little alcohol, they took a little Ambien at the same time. Of course they're unresponsive. They just knock themselves out.
You, going back to the story of Betty, the mother and grandmother and widow who became addicted to prescription medications, you describe some of her behaviors as behaviors and experiences, including memory loss, slurred speech, impaired daily living skills. Her family, how are they to look at that and decide this is an addiction versus this is somebody who's depressed versus this is a form of dementia or any number of things? I think a lot of times typically people assume that if it's a problem and it's someone who they perceive as being older, it must be dementia.
And there's a good chart in my book that's called Some Overlapping Signs and Symptoms of Aging, Polypharmacy, and Addiction. And let's take addiction out of the picture for a second and see if people are more comfortable just saying dependence. There are many, many, many people out there that are dependent on their drugs. They don't run out of the prescription early. They take 4 Vicodin per day. They never exceed that daily dosage. They're always on time to get their refills. They've been doing that for 10 years. If you take that medicine away, that person's going to go into withdrawal. They may have withdrawal symptoms. So they become dependent on the medication and have to be tapered off of those medications. Does that mean they've been behaving addictively in the negative sense, as people would think? Lying, stealing, cheating, getting them on the internet, buying them off the street? No, not at all. So these are people who have been innocently dependent or addicted on medications that have been prescribed. They're very dangerous controlled substances and very useful controlled substances. Pain should be treated appropriately. Insomnia is a very difficult problem, but insomnia medications were only meant to be used for 2 weeks to 4 weeks for most people. Other non-medical interventions should be tried. So, what are some of the symptoms that someone might see? Neglecting responsibilities. In the aged person, they may be too tired or depressed and may neglect responsibilities. The person with the polypharmacy taking multiple drugs may be too high, too stoned on the drugs to realize that they're neglecting responsibilities, physical hygiene, that kind of stuff, or even duties around the house, leaving the gas on, leaving the door open, leaving the phone off the hook. Or in addiction, the alcohol or drug is more important than the responsibility. So, you know, there's ways of comparing these three different things: aging, which is a normal process, polypharmacy, which is preventable, addiction, which is treatable. Other symptoms that we pay attention to: getting involved in dangerous activities like driving, getting into legal difficulties like, again, driving, disorderly conduct, problems with relationships, and problems of forgetfulness. And forgetfulness, early onset of age-related forgetfulness or early dementia, that kind of stuff can be a problem. Bad drug combinations, as I mentioned, can be a problem, and certainly too much of a controlled substance can be a problem. So, you know, it really has to be looked at by a good addiction professional, I think good healthcare professional, or just a caring primary care doctor, but never discount the possibility that things are worse than they seem. If dad and mom are behaving in a way that you're not used to, if leaving the gas on, leaving the door open, yelling at the grandchildren, forgetting certain duties or responsibilities they've never forgotten in the last 50 years, filing income tax, getting the mail out of the mailbox, you know, they're letting their appearance dwindle, let's rule out the things we can do something about. Polypharmacy, we can do something about. Addiction, we can do something about. And aging is something we can do more gracefully.
So again, what I hear you asking of folks essentially is to throw out those myths that many of us carry around with respect to the aging population, that the first sign of difference either means, well, they're old and that's what happens when you're old, or it means they're struggling with dementia. Throw Right. those myths out and pay careful attention and get help. Ask questions.
Great.
I noticed that with the deterioration of physical appearance, for example, I'm looking at your sign and symptoms chart in Not As Prescribed. If it's aging, it could be dementia. But if it's polypharmacy, a deterioration of physical appearance, it could be a bad drug combination. Again, not something that we typically think about in this age range population. And you also, under the addiction column, if they're indifferent to their physical appearance, again, many people would say, oh, well, they're old, it must be dementia, when in fact it could be addiction. So it's critically, critically important to pay attention and to not just rely on the old myths that many folks walk around with.
Right. And, you know, we get into this state of complacency is another common reaction to changes in an older adult's behavior. Most of us confuse complacency with acceptance. If you and others accept the changes as expected in the older person, you know, you got to consider the difference between aging and getting old. There's a chronological aging process where you keep having birthdays. And there's a biological aging process where people who take good care of themselves, don't get involved in polypharmacy, are staying active, stimulating their mind, going out and doing some walking, eating the proper foods, not spending all their time in front of that TV or box or whatever, are living full and productive and wonderful lives.
So again, throw out the myths because they might be just that.
Absolutely.
The idea that docs should speak to each other, yes, we know that very frequently that doesn't happen. Is that something that everyone, perhaps not just the aging population, should request of their doc, that he or she is communicating with the other folks who are treating that individual?
Yeah, I understand that in this era of managed care and Obamacare, people are not spending a lot of time with patients, and people think that the doctor spends all of his time looking at a computer. But it would be very important to come in with a report from one doctor's office, hand it to another doctor's office, and say, I expect this to be in my father's chart, and I expect someone to read it and comment to me about it, period. That's a reasonable expectation. Let's make sure that he's not getting the same medications or conflicting medications from two different fronts. Do you have reports from Dr. A in Dr. B's chart? Because we told Dr. A and we signed the permission slips that Dr. A should communicate the visit to the neurologist with my primary care doctor. You got to follow up on it. You have to. No one can do this better than the patient and their family. You have to be your own advocate
now,
in this health system.
Speaking of patient and their family, what if a family member really begins to have a sense that clearly there's something going on. They don't know what, but they want mom or dad or whomever to get an evaluation. And that person says, I'm not getting an evaluation. I don't need it. I'm fine. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, that's an intervention process, really. The evaluations were designed for those people, really, who didn't think they had a problem in the midst of denial. Interventions were designed to confront a person with obvious problems on the impact of those problems on other people in their lives, which is oftentimes quite revealing. An evaluation process is oftentimes a 2 or 3 day ordeal or therapeutic evaluation. They get a history, a physical examination. One person coordinates all those different doctors, finds all the doctors' reports, interviews family members about their concerns. Patient has an addiction medicine evaluation, psychological evaluation, psychiatric evaluation, and if warranted, psychometric or cognitive testing. All that is put together in one document, and the patient is then sat down in an exit interview with family present, and you say, judging from this evaluation, you do or do not have a problem that's more than aging and more than polypharmacy. This is an addictive problem that requires treatment. That's a big deal. That document has a lot of power, and treatment options are usually given at that time. You can lead a horse to water, but if someone then refuses under that kind of evidence, but at least you have the evidence.
I see. And if they refuse, if they continue to refuse, what do you do?
And then the family should be treated. The family itself should go and have their own feelings dealt with. There are family programs that are extraordinary all over the country. Betty Ford, Hazelden has wonderful family programs. The Blanchard Institute in North Carolina is one that has a wonderful family program. Most major treatment centers, you can treat the family who is affected by someone's drug or alcohol use independently of treating the patient.
Okay.
So they literally, it's basically Al-Anon and tells you how to react or deal with being involved in a relationship with an active alcoholic or addict. And there should be some boundaries that give you a life back and you're not just held hostage by someone else's disease.
Which I think happens also. So the fact that there are programs that will treat the family even if the primary potential patient does not wish to be treated, I think is critically important. Dr. Harry, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation. And when we come back, I note that after 30 years in family medicine, you found yourself dealing with a challenge. When we come back, I'd like to talk about that. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Dr. Harry, who is the author of Not As Prescribed, A Guide for Family and Caregivers, Recognize and Facing Alcohol and Drug Misuse in Older Adults. Don't go away. We will return in just a moment. Dr. Harry, after 30 years in family medicine, you found yourself dealing with a challenge. What happened?
Well, I was an independent solo practitioner in Vermont on call literally for those 30 years all the time. And my life had been filled with that kind of imbalance, much to the detriment, I think, of my family, who suffered because of that workload. I tried to be there as often as I could for my patients, which was sometimes 24/7, and found that one way to cope with that state of imbalance was to make sure that you could get a good night's sleep. And sometimes that meant having a glass or two or three of wine in the evening to fall asleep. I come from a long family, a long line of people who have suffered with alcohol dependence, including my own siblings and my father and many of my uncles. And I could see that there was danger brewing in that relationship with alcohol. So I sought out some help and eventually came to the Betty Ford Center myself, to their healthcare professional program for treatment, earlier than later in my career, and found a real home. I switched gears and went into addiction medicine and have devoted myself really to dealing with that healthcare population.
So there is a program specifically for those in healthcare who are struggling with these kinds of issues.
Absolutely. There are programs for lawyers, for physicians, for nurses, for, you know, not that they're special in any other way than, you know, their drug and alcohol use gets tied in with the workplace. And in order to return to that workplace and not have it be dangerous, you need special peer review treatment so people can break through the malignant denial that exists in these situations, and most importantly, keep patients safe. And all of those people usually get into monitoring programs. The same is true for airline pilots. Airline pilots have this is an equal opportunity destroyer. You know, in general, 10% of the population is affected by the disease of chemical dependency or addiction. That's 10% of the clergy, 10% of the lawyers, 10% of the nuns, 10% of the Buddhist monks. You know, there should be across the board. And so no one is going to dodge the bullet. If you're part of the 10%, no matter what, certain demographics in safety-sensitive positions need specialized treatment. Very true for airline pilots, very true for physicians. And they are usually monitored for at least 5 years after treatment to make sure there's no relapse. Hence, they enjoy the highest rates of recovery from this disease as anyone, upwards of 78 to 90%.
That's interesting. So it sounds like if one is in the company of someone who seems to be behaving somewhat unusually, the better thing to do is not to dismiss it, but to try to inquire, try to get some information, and to certainly try to suggest an evaluation, whether or not they agree. But by all means, not ignore what you're seeing in front of you.
That's right. And if your doctor is smart, they'll move that on to a healthcare or addiction professional that can really help a family. You notice that my book was dedicated to my mother, that was a woman who dealt with chemical dependency in many of the men that she loved, my dad, her sons, and so forth. But it's also got a foreword by Susan Ford Bales, the daughter of Betty Ford.
Yes.
Basically, the question you just asked me is Betty Ford's story. Susan Ford Bales watched her mother deteriorate after they left the White House with medical conditions. She had breast cancer. She had a severe pain issue. Drugs and alcohol were being used, and she was becoming more and more dysfunctional. And the magical intervention and evaluation that took place at the behest of this very brave daughter produced a magic that today is known as the Betty Ford Center, with hundreds of thousands of people having their lives turned around by this process.
Well, it is indeed an extremely well-known and well-respected institution. For those folks who, particularly the baby boomers, who are hearing more and more, as we all are, about the value and the joys of medical marijuana, are you particularly concerned about that usage for the aging population?
Well, that's a good question. You know, if someone didn't want to get high on marijuana, and they wanted to take it for glaucoma, or they wanted to take it for the nausea associated with chemotherapy, or for chronic pain issues, it's available in pill form. And it's been my experience that most of the people who get marijuana cards for some of their medical problems are using it to get high. There's that subset of group of people where it may indeed be the lesser of evils. It may be a lot safer to use medical marijuana for chronic pain issues in an older person who doesn't have very significant lung-related issues, so smoking it is not rendering them breathless, where it may be appropriate. I am deathly afraid of marijuana usage, and medical marijuana usage and legalized marijuana in the younger population.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's absolutely addictive. I think it's absolutely a gateway drug. I see it every day. People refute that all the time. There was a recent radio broadcast on ESPN that was debating this issue, where many athletes apparently supported its legalization and use. I was very concerned that this was coming from a source that could really reach young people. We find that the marijuana complacency syndrome, lack of motivation syndrome, cognitive difficulties, decreased performance on advanced testing, decreased earning potential are real results of early marijuana use, to say nothing of some of the writings now about concomitant psychosis that can be produced by that drug when other drugs don't seem to produce that. So there's a body of literature out there strong enough to support that marijuana is, it's not going to go away. It's a money issue. Marijuana, legal marijuana, is around for one reason and one reason only. It's not to relieve the pain of the world. It's to relieve the financial difficulties of communities that want the tax revenue, in my opinion.
You sound pretty solid in your opinion.
Sometimes I have a big mouth.
It's interesting to hear you talk about a pill. I didn't realize that medical marijuana, and I may be the only person, but I didn't realize that medical marijuana also came in pill form.
Yeah, it's been around for years. It's called Marinol. But, you know, people smoking marijuana, when they go to the dope shop, they wind up getting marijuana. No one knows what the THC content is, one versus the other. And if you smoke one joint, two joints, three joints a day, some people are getting dosage A, some people are getting dosage B, some people are getting dosage C, which can be, you know, 10 times the potency difference in each individual's exposure. So a pill is a measured amount of THC that's delivered to people. It's been around for years.
It's interesting.
Now, I'm not saying that marijuana may not have some use in the human organism. There's a reason why our body has cannabinoid receptors, and there are lots of them. And, you know, 5,000 years of Chinese medicine cannot be all wrong. I'm not going there. I'm saying that legalized medical marijuana, where I see in my work kids who are, you know, 17 years of age being sent to a doctor to get a medical marijuana card, or 18 years of age, for headaches, migraine headaches, and then they wind up smoking in the family basement with impunity because they get a card. Eventually, I see those kids after the marijuana stops working, and they're getting more and more kids. I think about 10% of those kids exposed will get addicted to the marijuana and will be using other drugs by the time I see them. But, you know, here's where I work. I work at Ground Zero.
It's interesting to hear you state unequivocally that marijuana is a gateway drug.
Yes.
Period, end of story.
I believe that to be true.
Okay.
And by the way, most people that I know that are addicts or alcoholics started out with the worst gateway drug known to man, the one that has killed more people, caused more heartache, cost more money than anything on the planet, and that's nicotine.
Very interesting. So all kinds of reasons to not smoke anything, really.
Yeah, why?
I can't answer it.
No, I can't either.
The younger folks who, and when I say younger, I mean under 50, who are involved in traditional AA or other kinds of programs, they learn about slips, they learn about relapses. For the older population, is the course of treatment the same? Is the potential for relapses the same?
I'm not sure of that. That was a long question, so I'm not sure exactly of the crux of the question. Are people younger than 50 versus older than 50 at the same risk of relapse?
Yes.
I believe so.
Okay. And the course of treatment for the folks who are older than 50, older than 65, is there inpatient treatment available? Are there detox programs available? Are the same options available for the post-65 group as for the younger folks?
Yeah, they're few and far between. The best places like the Betty Ford Center that have older adult programs are going to use specific detox protocols that are more gentle, more prolonged, more aware of a person's delicate physical condition, and comforting. Their programs are designed to give the older person needed rest, to modify the physical activity a little bit so it's in their best interest. There's more time spent on Chai Chi than wall climbing. Dietary services may be much more available to accommodate special needs that people have in older age groups. And most importantly, they are with their peers. It's difficult for an older adult to identify with a kid who's slamming methamphetamine and heroin IV under a bridge, and listening to rave music. They don't identify nearly as well as with their peers, but we do not discount the wonderful magic of mentorship and some of those older adults who we actually will partner up with a younger person to guide them a little bit if that person is young enough and hasn't had good adult guidance in their life. Sometimes there's a magical relationship there as well.
It sounds interesting. Now, my awareness of the detox programs is that over the years, they've gotten shorter and shorter, and insurance has had a tremendous hand in that. Is there an average length of time that detox options are available at the Betty Ford Center?
I would say that's a variable. You know, it's a big gap. It could be reasonably anywhere from 6 to 21 days, depending on the usage history that someone may have. Some of the longer detoxes are benzodiazepine detoxes, which we like to do very slowly and very gently. That doesn't mean you're just in detox. You can be engaged in treatment, but still getting medications that are letting you down gently.
Okay. As we begin to close out our conversation today, there have been so many important pieces of information that you've shared with us. If there were one or two things that you really want the listeners to walk away with, what might they be?
Don't settle for the ageism argument that they're old anyway. It's not worth raising that specter of possibility that they're in trouble. Audit the medications for polypharmacy, and find a good collaborating physician, healthcare practitioner who will aid you in the investigation and struggle. Sit down with your siblings, if you're a caretaker family, and sit down with your siblings and really assess the quality of life you envision for mom or dad, and never give up. People in their 90s can enjoy very fulfilling lives. All you have to do is ask the grandchildren, and get to sit down with someone who's alive and present and smiling and gentle and shares their experience, strength, and hope with a kid, and you can see the magic, and the effort is certainly worthwhile.
And it absolutely is magic. Dr. Harry Hertunian, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. And again, folks, the name of the book is Not As Prescribed, Recognizing and Facing Alcohol and Drug Misuse in Older Adults, A Guide for Families and Caregivers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that email is pamela@mindtalk.org. Again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And of course, I want you to always remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's plainly unacceptable. You take care.